This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And let's begin this hour by noting that yesterday, we may just have entered a new phase in the war in Syria.
The indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, the killing of women and children and innocent bystanders by chemical weapons is a moral obscenity. By any standard, it is inexcusable, and despite the excuses and equivocations that some have manufactured, it is undeniable.
It wasn't the attack itself that changed the game, believed to be sarin gas used allegedly by the regime on civilians. That attack was last week. It wasn't the Syrians firing on UN inspectors yesterday, attempting to get to the scene of that attack outside Damascus in the suburb of Mu'adamiya. And then another attempt to inspect the site has been delayed today, we learn. The new phase, though, may be signaled in this unexpectedly passionate tone from the Secretary of State in his first real crisis moment at the State Department.
President Obama has also been in close touch with leaders of our key allies, and the president will be making an informed decision about how to respond to this indiscriminate use of chemical weapons. But make no mistake, President Obama believes there must be accountability for those who would use the world's most heinous weapons against the world's most vulnerable people.
But that's where the emotional Kerry statement ended. We had been told he would be taking questions in the State Department briefing room yesterday, but he left without making clear what the word accountability meant. We learned this morning that Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel says, at least he told the BBC at a meeting in Brunei of Asian leaders, that the Pentagon is ready to go if called. Joining us is Michael Singh, who served in the National Security Council for 3 years as senior director for Middle East Affairs and as director for Iran, Syria, Egypt, and North Africa. He's now managing director at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Michael Singh, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
So what do you think accountability means? The military always says it's ready to go when called, but it would appear that this would be a limited response in any event.
Well, John, I think the first question with any such overseas military operation needs to be not so much what, but to what end. And that so far is not entirely clear. There's been a bit of strategic incoherence from the administration on Syria. We've heard lots of objectives sort of put out there from the get-go here, for that Assad must go, that we need to support the opposition, that the use of chemical weapons is unacceptable and perhaps a red line. As well as the sort of brutalization of the civilian population is somehow triggering a response. But exactly what we hope to achieve is not clear, and that leads to, I think, a lack of clarity as well as to what we are going to do.
Well, let's leave the military tactics to the tacticians. What do you think the word accountability means? I mean, what accountability can the U.S. enforce on Bashar al-Assad?
Well, I think that the administration is using it here in sort of a narrow sense, that the use of chemical weapons violates an international norm and that must be responded to by the international community, in part to deter the use of chemical weapons in the future by Assad or others. And so it looks like accountability in this case means punishment. It means exacting a price for using these weapons.
I'm just thinking from the perspective of someone in a refugee camp in Turkey right now. That policy, that approach, if that's what the message is at the end of the day, we want to deter you from using chemical weapons, please don't ever do that again, it essentially permits, tacitly or otherwise, the creation of a million refugees already of children in Syria and essentially excuses, am I wrong to say that, the last 2 years of brutality?
Well, I think that there is some truth to that. I think that it's a confusing position that Secretary Kerry took yesterday because he said it's a moral obscenity that these chemical weapons were used. But, of course, there have been over 100,000 people killed, killed through brutal means such as torture. Children have been killed. In fact, it was the torture of children that began this conflict back in early 2011. And there hasn't been very much response at all from the international community. And so it's again, difficult, I think, to understand why this constitutes an outrage, but the previous actions of the regime did not.
Would you say the policy of the administration right now is to maintain a stalemate in Syria, and does that have strategic advantages, essentially contain what's going on here?
I think it's been more, frankly, avoidance. I think the administration has sought to avoid American entanglement in Syria because they see it as essentially a quagmire that could turn into another Iraq. And I think this has been most obvious in the statements not of President Obama or Secretary Kerry, but of our military leadership. Remember that General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, addressed the question of a limited cruise missile strike on Syria recently in a letter to Congress. And he basically said, look, this would take hundreds of ships and aircraft, it would cost billions of dollars, and it's not clear what it would accomplish. And yet we find that that's exactly what the administration is considering doing now.
What would you do that would constitute, no longer a policy of avoidance that might change the stalemate on the ground? And what sort of coalition could you hope to gather to join you in that?
Well, I think, look, if the objective here is to end the conflict and to bring it to some kind of political resolution, to end the threat not only to American strategic interests in the region, but to end this humanitarian catastrophe that's unfolding, then I think this may be a moment where we might be able to build a diplomatic coalition in the region and around the world to do that. The question of how to do it, I think, is a complicated one, and it involves a multi-part policy. I think you would probably need some kind of external military intervention against the regime to tip the balance of power against it. But given the stage of the conflict that we're at and the power of the jihadists among the opposition, you would also need to try to change the balance of power within the opposition against the jihadists, which means a very serious effort to strengthen the secular opposition. I think that even if you can accomplish this, I think it would be hard, but even if you can accomplish this, that whatever government results in Damascus, whether by political solution or some other effort, would still be fighting for quite some time against the jihadists that now are pretty firmly ensconced in Syria.
Well, vetting the opposition is a quagmire, as you describe, or would possibly be a quagmire, as you describe it. And geostrategically, if we think about the region, next stop after Syria is Iran. Do you believe that's one of the constraints, that the U.S. would undoubtedly be confronting Iran if it intervened here?
Well, I think there are two ways of looking at this. I think there are some, and probably this is true in the Pentagon, who worry that getting involved in Syria, especially in an open-ended way, would divert resources that we need to have available in case there's a conflict with Iran. Remember, it's also taking place against the backdrop of a so-called pivot to Asia, where we're trying to shift our security resources, which are increasingly limited, to that continent. I think others, though, might say, and I think there is some legitimacy to this, that taking action in Syria quite firmly would send a message to the Iranians, especially because the Iranians are so deeply engaged in Syria, and might enhance the credibility of U.S. military threats against the Iranian regime.
Michael Singh is former senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, now managing director at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Michael Singh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we think of the Gulf War as that little conflict set off when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990 and was repulsed by a huge coalition of allies in 1991. But the people of Iraq and Iran think of the Persian Gulf War as a much longer, bloodier conflict that took place during the 1980s over disputed territory on the northern edge of the Persian Gulf, which Iraq called the Arabian Gulf. The war between Saddam Hussein and Ayatollah Khomeini was one of the most brutal slaughters of the late 20th century. Missiles targeted its cities, chemical weapons facing waves of, in some cases, child soldiers who were mowed down until the battlefield itself was choked with corpses. The U.S. seemed to favor no winners in this conflict and certainly would do nothing to help Iran.
We're still holding back on that because the Secretary General of the United Nations is still seeing if he cannot persuade Iran to cooperate. If they don't, then we will have to face, in the Security Council, the adoption of the second proviso, which is the arms embargo on Iran.
President Reagan, back in 1987, an effort that seemed to the world to be a way of ending the Iran-Iraq war. But recently, declassified documents from the CIA tell a different story, that the U.S. played favorites in this conflict, in this stalemate, and actually gave assistance to Iraq, and in return was kept informed of the use of chemical weapons by Iraq, a practice the U.S. seemed to condone. With us is Rick Francona. He's a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel and a liaison officer in Baghdad during the 1980s. Colonel, welcome.
Nice to be with you, John.
So let's talk first of all about how much of a surprise this is. The declassified documents, that was inevitable. It was a Freedom of Information request, but there was a lot of suspicion about this.
Well, it was good to see the information come out. I mean, I was familiar with those documents. I had read them in the past. We were very aware through intelligence sources of Iraqi use of mustard gas in the early 1980s and their desire to develop a credible nerve agent capability. But it took them a long time to do that. Their earlier use of nerve agent was really ineffective. They couldn't get the formula right. They couldn't get the employment right. Even though they were trying to use nerve agents in 1984, they were not very successful at it. We didn't see Iraqi success with the nerve agent until 1988. They were, at the time, continuing to deny the existence of chemical weapons in their inventory. I mean, I flat out asked them on numerous occasions, are you using chemical weapons? The answer was always the same, no, we don't own them.
But on some level, strategically, did the U.S. tolerate the use of chemical weapons by Iraq and hoped that Iraq would, if not win the war, keep Iran at bay indeterminately?
I know. I think that's exactly right. This happened in for sure in 1988. In 1988, we were involved with the Iraqis. I was in Baghdad working with the Iraqi military, and we were helping them, of course, hoping to prevent the Iranians from winning. This was really not about the Iraqis. It was much more about preventing the Iranians from achieving a victory in the Persian Gulf and allowing them, of course, to spread their ideology wherever they wished. So after they liberated the Fal Peninsula, I was on the battlefield and I discovered a lot of atropine injectors. Now, atropine injectors, as most people know, is the military's antidote for a nerve agent. And the stuff was all over the battlefield. I asked the Iraqis, what is this? And they said, well, we use a lot of smoke in our artillery fire. And it may have confused the Iranians. They thought they were in a chemical attack. You know, we didn't buy the explanation, but it was an explanation. So I came back to the embassy in Baghdad, reported this to Washington. I also had some of the samples of the materials that immediately halted our program with the Iraqis. But a few weeks later, we were told to resume. And, of course, not being privy to the meetings, I can only imagine that the decisions were based on two very bad choices. You can assist the Iraqis, even though they're using chemical weapons, and achieve your national security objective of not allowing the Iranians a victory in the Persian Gulf. Or the other choice would be to halt all relationships with the Iraqis and risk an Iranian victory. So we opted to continue our assistance to the Iraqis.
Bad options in the Persian Gulf War back in the 1980s, an echo of what's going on in Syria as the U.S. considers its options there. Rick Francona is a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel and a former liaison officer in Baghdad. Later this hour, J.D. Salinger is back as five new finished manuscripts are being prepared for publishing several years after his death. We're asking you about the books and authors that have influenced your lives.
Hi, my name is Sue from Hillsboro. The novel that really changed my outlook was Women in Love by D.H. Lawrence. This is when I first experienced depth of human emotion and human feeling and human love.
Of course, one of you in New York City picks Moby Dick. As much of a challenge as it was to get into the flow of, once I did, it opened up like a flower that blossoms in me to this day. Thanks for that. And from Allenwood, New York, you said A Happy Death by Albert Camus. Read the whole book in a few hours, and it made me rethink how I perceive my whole world. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Share the book that changed your life. Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Confronting a religious conflict is just one of the challenges facing the Obama administration in the Middle East and particularly Syria. The battle between religious and secular movements in politics has defined the history of the Middle East in our time. It's also created challenges in our own domestic politics. Are there ways that the U.S. could get the attention of faith communities around the world in an organized way? The U.S., compared to other industrialized nations, is a very religious, self-identified, church-going country. Well, a new initiative at the State Department aims to take advantage of that to promote an American vision of morality and human rights from the congregations on up. The U.S. already has an ambassador at large for international religious freedom, but this new initiative is more general. Sean Casey is director of the State Department's new Office of Faith-Based Community Initiatives and says his mission is to try and open channels to some of the most difficult to talk to groups in the world.
It's very risky to sort of talk in the abstract about the religious community. I mean, that actually doesn't shed a lot of light on anything. So our diplomacy really has to be context-dependent. So our staffers and ambassadors on the ground have to understand the religious dynamics in their particular country or in their particular region. Now, obviously, when you're dealing with groups that have espoused violence, there's really a limitation on what somebody, say, in my position is going to be able to do in terms of engaging with folk. But obviously, this office is going to try to be as inclusive and as expansive as possible. I want to engage with anybody who's willing to talk to us, but we're not going to put anybody's lives at risk in that process.
Do you think the principle of separation of church and state in the United States disqualifies someone in the Office of Faith-Based Community Initiatives at the State Department because people view the U.S. as not giving the same kind of political credibility to religious groups as might be the case elsewhere?
Well, let me just say I've discovered the State Department actually has a vast array of First Amendment lawyers here that I've been conversing with on a regular basis. Nothing this office does is going to violate the Establishment Clause or the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. We're not going to be granting money, so we can't discriminate in terms of grants that we make because I'm not going to be making any. We have to be vigilant in not endorsing particular religions. We can't promote religion over non-religion. But empirically, what we're going to be doing is trying to find faith-based communities and other civil society groups that are willing to partner with us on aid, willing to partner with us on the promotion of human rights, and also be with us trying to mitigate and reverse conflict and build peace. So we're going to take them where we find them in that sense.
Do religious groups around the world have a different view of this separation of church and state? And does that reduce your credibility with them? Do they say, oh, well, you're really limited. You're talking to lawyers. You're not talking to God.
Well, I have not had that experience yet. And if I have that experience, then we'll try to have a more sophisticated conversation. The separation of church and state means we do not have an established church. Our government doesn't endorse any particular form of religion. But that doesn't prevent us from engaging with religious groups and faith communities across the world if, in fact, it would be helpful to us in promoting our values and our foreign policy to do so. I mean, you think about it, there are some regions where, in fact, you don't have things approaching our notion of separation of church and state, and yet religion cuts across their policies and politics. So if we want to engage them fruitfully, we have to engage them as they are religious actors.
So let's talk about how religion can be used to suppress certain moral issues as well as to expand on certain moral issues. Why isn't there more common ground among religious communities about the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities? The last time Congress dealt with that, there was a religious movement against it as well as a faith-based movement that would endorse the U.S. ratification of that treaty.
Well, I do think the overwhelming majority of the world's religions do get or understand from their perspectives the moral basis for this treaty. After all, you know, there are something like, 135 or 150 nations which have endorsed the treaty, which tells me there are a lot of different faith communities that do, in fact, support it. In terms of what happened last year, you know, I was not in the State Department at that point, so I really can't get down in the weeds on what transpired in the Senate vote. But in my conversations with a fairly diverse group of religious folk, I sense a great symmetry between various forms of religious values and the values that are encapsulated in this treaty.
Secretary Kerry was really a supporter of the treaty in the Senate, and I think bore some personal heartbreak with the outcome of that vote. What have your conversations with him or contacts with him been like about the importance of this treaty to him now that he's Secretary of State?
Oh, I think it is something that's deep. It's deeply personal for him. I think he sees this as a treaty that can literally improve the lives of potentially hundreds of millions of people going forward. If we endorse the treaty and if we sort of get universal global participation in the treaty, that's going to change the lives of literally hundreds of millions of people. So he has a passion about it. I think it's something that he's deeply concerned about. So your assessment is dead on. I think this is something that is clearly a policy priority for him going forward.
So aside from the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, what else is on your to-do list as you look forward, Sean Casey?
Well, if you think about it, I've got a number of jobs. The secretary gave me a really large mandate a couple of weeks ago when we did my rollout, and he simply said that drawing on his personal experiences as a senator and now in his tenure as Secretary of State, he has seen and he's known the power of faith communities to do good in the world. Now, he also has seen some of the power of religion to do less than good things in the world. He believes that we need to partner with as many faith partners as are willing to meet with us to talk about these issues of poverty and climate change, human rights, and conflict mitigation. So basically, he's got some personal issues, some signature issues he's asking me to help on. Secondly, part of what I'm trying to do here is to increase the capacity across the State Department to do more fruitful religious engagement, and then my office will be something of a customer service window, if you will, for NGOs that want to partner with the State Department. They can come to us, and we can be sort of the traffic director to tell them where to go and partner if they're a faith-based NGO looking for the right people to talk to here in the State Department.
Well, I'd say, just as a friendly colleague, that we'll say a prayer for your success, but I know that'll just get you in trouble.
Yeah, that's right. Well, listen, I'll take all the help I can get. I never turn that down. Thank you.
Sean Casey is the head of the new Office of Faith-Based Community Initiatives at the U.S. Department of State. Thanks so much, Sean.
You're welcome. Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
In live sports,
in right field, Tarasco.
When the fans in the stands get into the act,
going back to the track, to the wall,
it can be a disaster.
And what happens here?
Much as he wanted to be on the field, 12-year-old fan Jeffrey Mayer's touch of Derek Jeter's fly ball helped make it a home run back in 1996. It was a win for the Yankees, a bitter, nasty loss for the Baltimore Orioles. Sporting events are increasingly getting fans into the act in other less controversial ways, though, to make everyone winners, regardless of their team allegiance or political outlook. The sports industry, you see, is going green, as in environmentally green. The National Green Sports Alliance is holding its annual convention here in the Big Apple, city of the upcoming Super Bowl in 2014. Martin Tull, the executive director of the Alliance, says being green is a team color in all sports these days.
Within the Green Sports Alliance, we have about 180 sports venues that we're working with across North America. Of those, nearly all have adopted some sort of recycling or composting strategy. About 13 or 14 have on-site solar installations.
What are those? I mean, it's like...
Well, the Lincoln Financial Field, MetLife Stadium... Cleveland Indians have also wind turbines installed there. So there's a number of facilities that are both adopting energy efficiency measures, recycling and waste strategies, green cleaning strategies, and then on-site renewables.
So the tribe, the Cleveland Indians, who've had such trouble getting balls to go out of the park because of the wind right there by the Great Lakes, they're actually utilizing that wind.
They are, absolutely. Turn it the other way.
Because the fans don't like the wind in that stadium, particularly as it hampers the home team. And this is so much bigger than recycling. It seems to me that you've got people to think hard about what they eat as well as what they do with their trash.
That's right.
Questions of parking, energy use, the kinds of lighting used at stadiums. These are all cost factors for teams that are really important. And how aware are fans that all this is going on?
Well, I think the next generation of fan is very aware. I mean, when they go to the venue, they expect to see recycling stations there. They expect to see efficient lighting. There's a much higher expectation from the younger generation than older. But I think that we're seeing the same response from fans in venues around the country. Wherever these measures have been installed, they've been getting very positive feedback from their fans, encouraging them to do more.
And you don't get an issue in sports venues of climate change, or that's some sort of lefty kind of thing, organic food that's not manly enough for us. All those sorts of political divisions that make it so difficult to talk about some of these issues, do they vanish when you get inside of a sports stadium?
Well, I think sports is a great equalizer. And you don't have to talk about climate change to talk about how the team was able to save millions of dollars through their new lighting retrofit. So there are ways of talking about these things so that it fits in with the sports culture. You're never going to take away the hot dog from the ballpark, but you can also add sushi, and people may want that. So there's a way of improving the way that things are done, not taking away from the fan experience at all, and actually improving it.
I'm intrigued that one of the sessions at your convention here in New York involves getting people who are fans to eat as well as the athletes.
That's right. It's a new frame that we're bringing forward in the Alliance, asking people, you know, what would it look like if you were to eat like a high performance athlete? And it doesn't mean taking away certain things. It means being more thoughtful about what it is that you're doing.
And does that reduce the amount of beer consumption at the stadium?
Well, you know, we hope it doesn't change all things.
I see. The Super Bowl is in New York at MetLife Stadium. If it's really cold, that could definitely reduce the sort of green imprint of MetLife Stadium. Mm. They'll need to run some heaters at the Super Bowl.
Right.
What are you hoping for? Good weather, cold weather, or warm weather?
Well, no, I hope it'll be warm and sunny, but we'll have to see. But, you know, they do have a couple thousand solar panels up there as well, so they can run some of the heat off that.
All right. Martin Tall is the executive director of the Green Sports Alliance here in New York for their annual meeting. Thanks so much.
John, thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and here's the perfect metal soda can. Right? Can you hear that? But I, crunched it. It's dented now, kind of messed up. Let's see if I can get it back. Oops. Oh, man. This just looks like a piece of trash. And according to a recent study on how our mind works with the things we recycle, if we see a metal soda can as damaged, like this one, we're much more likely to throw it in the trash rather than recycle it. Pristine recyclables are still good, useful, we think. Things that are damaged, yuck, who'd want that trash? This appears to be true for other recyclables, paper, plastic, cardboard boxes, and clothes hangers, according to Jennifer Argo, professor of marketing, law, economics, and business at the University of Alberta, and is one of the authors of a new study looking into the sort of psychology of recyclables. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
So how did you do this study, and what was your supposition here?
Well, we did two different things. The first is what we call an observation study, which means my co-author went into the rooms of a bunch of secretaries in the university and looked into their recycling bins as well as their garbage cans and counted how many pieces of paper were in each of the bins and also the size of the papers, and found in that study that people were more likely to put the larger pieces of paper into the recycling bin but the smaller ones into the trash. The other way that most of the studies were done were in the lab, where we had people come in, they were given a product, they wrote a short little writing task about it, did some other stuff in between, and then were told to dispose of their product on the way out the door. The product was either a piece of paper or aluminum cans. And then what we did is we basically just watched and looked to see whether or not people would put their product into the garbage bin or into the recycling bin.
And a damaged product was overwhelmingly more likely to be thrown in the trash, or just there was a vague preference one way or the other?
It was completely overwhelming. Absolutely. You dented the can and it was almost guaranteed to be going into the garbage.
Now, what do you think is going on here? Do people think, oh, that's kind of dirty, I don't want to touch it, I'll throw it in the trash? Or is there something deeper happening?
When people see a can, as you described, or a piece of paper that's not a regular 8.5 by 11, it's different than what their standard is for that product category. And as a product becomes less standard or less typical, it becomes less useful for that product. And so a dented can is no longer that pristine can. It's not as useful. And things that are not useful are equated with the garbage can.
We're so weird in our minds. I mean, we know intellectually that the can gets melted down and turns into other cans. It's not like they line up the cans and put them in the dishwasher. So what's going on here? Why can't we understand that, you know, wrinkled up paper is just as valuable to be pulped as pristine paper?
Well, I think part of it is that our default is probably everything goes in the garbage. And it takes an extra active thought to say, you know what, actually, this could be recycled. And so any reason that would be consistent with the notion that this is garbage is going to increase the likelihood that's exactly where the product is going to go. And so we want to make quick decisions. And so you don't want to have to look at that can and think about, you know, okay, this is actually okay after all. I don't need to throw it in the garbage and so forth. So it's a quick decision.
So what's the solution here, Professor? Do we put a product label on here saying, even if I'm dented, still put me in recycling? That's where I belong.
Well, I think I honestly think that that's part of it. Maybe not a label, but messages to consumers. I mean, consumers are really smart, right? And so if they hear stuff repetitively and important information, eventually it does sink in. It's not like we were hardwired to assume that this stuff goes into the garbage. My daughter in kindergarten, I went in their class and they had recycling bins next to the door. I look in and they had small pieces of paper in there. And I was like, oh dear, I'm glad you're not my participants because you would have totally ruined my study. But the point is that they still saw these small pieces of paper as useful. And so kids are doing it. So I think there's hope for the rest of us that we can learn, and perhaps manufacturers actually helping as well with the type of packaging that they choose to use. Don't give us the plastic that's really, really hard to open that you have to take scissors to and then completely destroy it. That's going to probably go into the garbage.
And there's hope for the world if the young people like your daughter are actually getting this way more quickly than the rest of us. Jennifer Argo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Argo is professor of marketing, law, economics, and business at the University of Alberta in Canada. Look out, folks. There will apparently be more madman stuff after Pensy Prep and more of all that David Copperfield crap apparently coming down the literary pipe from that writer who, first of all, wants you to know that the one thing he hates is the movies. Yes, J.D. Salinger is back. Maybe not Holden C. or Franny and Zoe, but perhaps five manuscripts are heading towards publication. Not unfinished stuff found by people cleaning up Salinger's desk, but five finished books with instructions to be published after his death. A rare request from an author known as much for his reclusive weirdness as for his classics like Catcher in the Rye. A writer who retained
this almost religious loyalty. And it's a phenomenon, I think, almost unique to Salinger that, you know, while many writers are revered for their work, he almost, you know, alone among literary figures has achieved this kind of mythological status. And he was somewhat, you know, a mythological figure for me. He cast a very long shadow.
That's writer Joyce Maynard, who opened a window onto Salinger's opaque world when in 1998 she disclosed an affair she had with him, earlier recounted, in her memoir At Home in the World, the story of being a teenage girl in love with the master who eventually ditched her. Not even that scandal, though, could dent Salinger's godlike status, who granted a few interviews, none recorded. Reporter Betty Epps was granted one of those rare interviews while Salinger was in exile.
He said, I refuse to publish. He said, there is a marvelous peace in not publishing. He said, there's a stillness. And he said, when you publish, the world thinks you owe them something. He said, if you don't publish, they don't know what you're doing. And he said, you can keep it for yourself.
Salinger apparently said that back in 1980. Salinger hasn't published anything since 1965. Biographies have been attempted. Ian Hamilton managed to finish one. Salinger's daughter, Margaret, wrote a sad book about her troubled childhood more than a decade ago. Margaret Salinger was also aware of these new manuscripts awaiting J.D.'s death in 2010.
I do know he's been working all these years because probably the second time I'd ever been allowed in his study, he very proudly showed me a set of files where a red dot meant this is ready to go upon my death, a green dot meant this needs editing.
Margaret Salinger speaking there in a documentary film about all of this. A new window on J.D. Salinger, or five new windows? We turn now to Amy Hungerford, a professor of English and American Studies at Yale University. Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Green dots, red dots, all it does is increase the mystery surrounding J.D. Salinger. Your assessment of the importance of these five new manuscripts?
Well, I think it could cut two ways in terms of his legacy. On the one hand, we might see a writer who began to parody his early great works, who simply went back and re-tilled the same ground over and over. Or we might see a writer who has continued to grow and change and think and read. And in that case, I think it would be very exciting.
So if that is the scenario, these books would be nothing like Catcher in the Rye, a voice which was revolutionary in 1951 but is completely mainstream today in the memoir literature of the millennials and all of those voices which dominate young literature today.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the voices of writers like Dave Eggers or even Juno Diaz are profoundly influenced by the sense that Salinger laid out that you could have this male adolescent voice, slangy and profane, and it would just grab you by the ears and the heart and take you where it wanted you to go. But, you know, Juno Diaz's work has pushed that into really interesting directions lately. Salinger looks a little narrow in comparison to that later work.
And in a sense, these books would have to compete with the narrative of his life over these many years, a reclusive, mysterious figure, and that's difficult in its own way.
Yeah, it is. I mean, my sense of it, just from the descriptions, is that he stayed very much dedicated to the Glass family. The release of Glass family stories, I think, would be very satisfying to lovers of Salinger. It would be both new information about that imaginary family and also in keeping with what people have loved about his work. But something like a religious manual, I think, will then get read very much, as you say, back into the biography. And I think, in a way, that could be less interesting for those who love Salinger's early work.
It's hard to know what his observations about religion and the contemporary world might be because he lived in such a bubble. You don't get the sense that he's deeply engaged in the events of the day, like, say, a Don DeLillo or a Thomas Pynchon, who has his own reputation for exile and being reclusive.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think that our culture has lost sight of the fact that reclusion or a kind of monastic withdrawal is one way to engage the modern world. I think it's a mistake to think that that's not engagement. It may not be a kind of mimetic commitment, a commitment to imitate the world or reproduce it on the page and manipulate it, but a journey into the possibilities of the imagination. I think it's a shame to think of that as withdrawal, complete withdrawal from the world.
Finally, it's a bit ironic that on the second page of Catcher in the Rye, we learn that Holden Caulfield hates the movies more than anything, and yet it will be a documentary movie that announces all of this.
Well, you can also balance that by the sense that Buddy in Franny and Zoe calls those stories a home movie. So Salinger's relationship to film and also to drama is a complicated one. I think he probably loved it more than he hated it.
Yes, and I think all authors eventually come to that. My daughter Zoe wishes that we spelled her name the way Salinger spelled his Zoe in Franny and Zoe. Amy Hungerford, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Amy Hungerford is professor of English and American Studies at Yale University. So what books grabbed you by the ears and took your heart where they wanted you to go?
The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. It changed the way I think about the perceived monsters in this world. Everyone has their own story, and we shouldn't be so quick to judge. This is Josephine from Farmington Hills, Michigan.
Bruce from Tallahassee, Florida. Undoubtedly, the book that has influenced my view of the world the most was John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. I've read it a number of times, and it continues to impress upon me just the very best and the very worst of humanity and what it takes to get along in this world.
And you in Birmingham, Michigan, says Hemingway's Jack Adams stories. In 1969, I camped in my backyard for weeks pretending the big two-hearted was just outside the flaps. Great story. Keep them coming. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm just a face in the crowd. You probably don't know me as I don't stand out.
Wait, wait.
now a face from that crowd that gathered in Washington, D.C. 50 years ago tomorrow.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
It was a crowd of 250,000 people who witnessed that speech by Dr. Martin Luther King, people who came from across the country converging on the Washington Mall for a march remembered today as a high mark of the civil rights movement, but which was also a complicated piece of political radicalism that defined the decade of the 1960s. Our partner, the New York Times, solicited its readers to submit stories of that day from people who were there. Today's story comes from Dorothy Pittman Hughes, a civil rights activist who also helped to organize the march. She and the people who came to Washington brought their experiences of racism in the South to the cities of the North, a mission to make the civil rights struggle the national struggle it became.
I was from Georgia, and the way that the communities are built, we are still building black communities in the country. And the way the community is built, black people lived on one side of the railroad track and white people lived on the other side. And they worked together every day. But on weekends, there were KKK rides down through the community. They could just shoot in the window. So on Friday night, usually, we slept on the floor on a pallet. My mother and father would take the mattresses off the bed and put them on the floor, and that way we had more protection. So I came up in a time when racism was really heavy. We didn't have integrated schools. The books that I had to use, that we used, were always books coming from the white schools, and they always had insults written all through them, the N-word and all kinds of problems. So I grew up developing ways to survive. And when Emmett Till was killed, that was the end of it for me. I didn't look back. I just got totally into the movement, and I'm still here.
So all that KKK shooting and the N-words in the textbooks was all about telling young people like you, don't get any ideas. Don't you think for a minute that you're going to step out of this place. We have you. And just the opposite happened.
Well, the opposite happened across the country in a lot of ways, but to tell you the truth, it's the same thing is still happening now. People don't have to get under sheets anymore. They just openly say, I'm taking back my country, as if the country belongs to them. The Trayvon Martin situation was just like the Emmett Till situation. And here we are, years later, after Dr. King, we are going through the same thing. If you look at Harlem, I spent years in Harlem from 1957 until 2001, and it is totally gentrified now. People who have lived in Harlem for years, and it was considered the black Mecca, you can hardly find a family who's able to afford an apartment in Harlem today. So the same thing is going on. Dr. King spoke for Dr. King. He spoke for us, but he didn't speak for America. And we're still suffering, and people are afraid to talk about racism. But we need to get there, because without economic empowerment, there really is no change in the local communities.
Can you describe what you saw 50 years ago at the March on Washington when you suddenly realized just how many people had decided to participate?
I'd never seen so many people in my life. I cried a lot. Everybody around me were crying. I saw also the possibility of sisterhood. I was out there with people of all races from everywhere. And now, by the time of the march, we were not just dealing with civil rights and human rights. We were dealing with women's rights as well. And I really didn't know how connected all of those things were. So Dr. King's speech really was, he was speaking, but we felt that he was speaking for all of us.
You know, so many of us know of the March on Washington as Dr. King's speech and the memorable words of that speech and the dream. But I'm wondering if there's another vision, a snapshot that you carry with you of that day that we could have to fill out our picture of what happened 50 years ago.
Well, I actually think that if we look at what's going on now and we decide that we didn't finish the job and that we need to respect Dr. King's work enough to actually finish the job, everyone should take this 50th anniversary opportunity to really look at oneself and say, what have I done? What can I do to make America a real strong, beautiful place? Because I'm still suffering. I still have pain of racism, classism, and sexism.
Well, before we go, Dr. King, of course, said that he has a dream of a future America. And he said to the crowd, I might not get there with you. I'm wondering what Dorothy Pittman Hughes' dream is now. What would you change tomorrow? What would you make right to continue that vision that you saw 50 years ago?
What I would change right now is actually I'm doing what I want to do. And what I'm doing is I'm teaching parents and children and just community persons to grow food for themselves. The one thing that I think saved me a lot was the fact that I could think better if I wasn't hungry. And I walked out of our back door in Georgia into a garden. And across the street was a pear trees. And the pig pen was back there. The chicken coops was back there. The cows were back there. We weren't hungry. We were poor, but we weren't hungry. There is too much poverty right now. And people can look across the world and see hungry children, and they can't look down the block and see hungry children. And anybody listening, come on, work here. Do America. Feed some children down the street. Help.
Remembering 50 years after the March on Washington, Dorothy Pittman Hughes, thanks so much.
I thank you. I thank you, thank you, thank you.
Dorothy Pittman Hughes, civil rights activist who helped to organize the March on Washington 50 years ago this week. And we're collecting your dreams for the next 50 years.
I would like to see this country in the next 50 years become self-sufficient in its resources.
I just hope in the next 50 years we have a more compassionate, kind world where we see each other as individuals.
I wish everybody would examine their consciences, read their scriptures, and live by it.
My dream for America is that we, in 50 years, will have changed the gun culture and have stopped people from dying here.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway using the hashtag MyDream. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
How many miles must we march? How many miles must we march? How many miles must we march? Whoa, how many miles must we march? How many miles must we march? How many miles? Whoa, how many miles?
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.